Damadava Jaya Kunja Bihari Jaya Radha Madhava Jaya Kunja Bihari Jaya Gopi Channa Vallabha Jaya Giridhara Dhari Jaya Giridhara Dhari Yashoda Nandana Braja Jana Ranjana Yashoda Nandana Braja Jana Ranjana Yamuna Tira Banachahari Jaya Radha Madhava Jaya Kunja Bihari Hare Krishna, Krishna Krishna, Hare Hare, Hare Rama, Hare Rama, Rama Rama, Hare Hare.
Hare Krishna, Hare Krishna, Krishna Krishna, Hare Hare, Hare Rama, Hare Rama, Rama Rama, Hare Hare.
Hare Krishna. Krishna, Krishna, Hare Hare, Hare Rama, Hare Rama, Rama Rama, Hare Hare.
Hare Krishna, Hare Krishna, 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 Hare Hare. Prabhupada Srila Prabhupada
Jaya Prabhupada Jaya Prabhupada Prabhupada Srila Prabhupada
Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya
Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya
Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya
Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya
Narayanam Namaskritya
Narayanam Namaskritya
Naram Chaiva Narottamam
Naram Chaiva Narottamam
Devim Sarasvatim Vyasam
Devim Sarasvatim Vyasam
Tato Jayam Udiraye
Tato Jayam Udiraye
Nashta Prayeshu Padreshu
Nashta Prayeshu
Nityam Bhagavata Sevaya Bhagavati Uttama Shloke Bhaktir Bhavati Naishtiki. Thank you for allowing me to speak on the Bhagavatam today. I'm requesting the blessings of the senior Vaishnavas as well as all the Vaishnavas. Please bless me, I can say something helpful today. We are on Canto 1, Chapter 13, Dhritarashtra quits home, Shloka 23. Om Mahi Asi Jantor. Jivitasha Yatabhavan Vima Bhavarjitam Pindam Adate Griha Palavat Omahi Ashi Janto Jivitasha Yatabhavan Vima Bhavarjitam Pindam Adate Griha Palavat.
Adate Griha Palavat.
Ahomahi Asi Janto. Jivitashaya Tavavan. Vima Pavarjitam Pindam. Adate Griha Palavat. Shri Chantor Vipashaya Tabhavan Vina Pavarjitam Tindam Adate Griha Pavat. Omahiya Shri Chantor Jivitashaya Tabhavan Chitam Pindam Adate Griha Palavat Homaliya Shri Janto Jivitashaya Tavavan Vima Pavarjitam Pindam Adate Griha Palavat. Synonyms, please repeat along if you would like. Aho, alas, Mahiyasi, powerful, Janto, of the living beings, Jivita Asha, hope for life, Yata, as much as, Bhavan, you are, Bhima, of Bhima stand, a brother of Yudhishthir's, Apavarjitam, remnants, Pindam, Pustha, Adate, eaten by, Griha Palavat, like a household dog. Translation. Alas, how powerful are the hopes of a living being to continue his life. Verily, you are living just like a household dog and are eating remnants of food given by Bhima. This is Vidura speaking to Dhritarashtra. Please, let's do responsively. Alas, how powerful are the hopes of a living being to continue his life. Verily, you are living just like a household dog. And are eating remnants of food given by Bhima. Purport by Srila Prabhupada. Sadhu should never flatter kings or rich men to live comfortably at their cost. A sadhu is to speak to the householders about the naked truth of life so that they may come to their senses about the precarious life and material existence. Dhritarashtra is a typical example of an attached old man in household life. He had become a pauper in the true sense, yet he wanted to live comfortably in the house of the Pandavas, of whom Bhima especially is mentioned because personally he killed two prominent sons of Dhritarashtra, namely Duryodhan and Dushasana. These two sons were very much dear to him for their notorious and nefarious activities, And Bhima is particularly pointed out because he killed these two pet sons. Why was Dhritarashtra living there at the house of the Pandavas? Because he wanted to continue his life comfortably, even at the risk of all humiliation. Vidura, therefore, was astonished how powerful is the urge to continue life. This sense of continuing one's life indicates that a living being is eternally a living entity and does not want to change his bodily habitation. The foolish man does not know that a particular term of bodily existence is awarded to him to undergo a term of imprisonment, and the human body is awarded, after many, many births and deaths, as a chance for self-realization to go back home, back to Godhead. But persons like Dhritarashtra tried to make plans to live there in a comfortable position, with profit and interest, for they do not see things as they are. Dhritarashtra is blind and continues to hope to live comfortably in the midst of all kinds of reverses in life. A sadhu like Vidura is meant to awaken such blind persons and thus help them go back to Godhead, where life is eternal. Once going there, no one wants to come back to this material world of misery. We can just imagine how responsible a task is entrusted to a sadhu like Mahatma Vidura. Pancha kalpatibhyascha kripa sindhubhya eva cha patita nam pavanibhya vaishnavibhya namah. So this whole class will be about how to not be grihapalavat, or like a household dog, is the central theme in this chapter. So what is a household dog? The point was made that Dhritarashtra was overly attached to material life, right? Overly attached. So how can we see that in the light of our own life, and how not to be a household dog, like a household dog, Grihapalavat? If we are endeavoring in devotional service in a proper way and on a daily basis, have a nice daily sadhana, then we are not a household dog, right? So if we are properly situated within devotional service, we are endeavoring to our best ability on a daily basis, regular. It's also helpful to be properly balanced in your life, in your material life, within one's varna and ashram. That is also very helpful. Then we are not grihapalavat, like a household dog. We heard recently in Shloka 17, insurmountable, imperceptible time overcomes the insanely attached householder. Right? The insanely attached householder, he's overcome by insurmountable, imperceptible time. However, such illusion cannot overcome one engaged in devotional service. Right? Such illusion cannot overcome one engaged in devotional service. So that is the answer for not being an insanely attached householder, or grihapalavat, like a household dog. Right, but if we say that we are devotees, but we are living like, vishayis or grihamedis, we're not endeavoring on our level to the best of our ability, then there is a chance that we could slide over to that grihapalavat platform. Right? Such illusion cannot overcome one engaged in devotional service. So the answer is daily sadhana. The answer is engagement in devotional service. We have also heard recently in this chapter how there's no remedial measure for death. Right? Death comes either for a devotee, it's Krishna's arrangement, Krishna arranges death, or Krishna comes as kala, as time, for the non-devotees. Mm-hmm. And we've even seen in our midst that, many devotees have left our association. Not only the ones that are elderly, but also young ones. we're hearing how apakshaya, signs of dwindling, are like signs that death is nearing. But it's not always the case, right? There's plenty of young devotees from our community who have left us untimely and sometimes very surprisingly. So we never know when death will come, even if it's arranged by Krishna. So if we can, you know, have a daily sadhana and also have that idea that death may come at any moment, then we are properly situated. Right? Then we are not drinking the illusion of material life or what material life is. Right? You know, death can come at any moment, and I will get up today and I will practice accordingly. Death may meet me at any time, and there's no day like today to do my devotional service. So a household dog, he does not think like that, right? It says he is comfortable in this position in the material life, and he tries to live material life with profit and interest. So that is a household dog, like a household dog. I said in the purport, for they do not see things as they are, right? They do not see death coming. Right? They think that this is a nice situation, I'm comfortable, and I'll just continue on as I am, but death comes eventually in one form or another. I had talked about the Titanic a few classes ago. I'm sort of like fascinated with Titanic. I'll just bring it up here again because it's sort of a nice illustration. So in 1912, the Titanic was supposed to be like the first of its kind ever made. It was supposed to be like an unsinkable ship, the way it was made. Its size, its unsinkability, its also its glamour. It was very luxurious and glamorous, like it had never been before for the first class passengers. And there were stately ballrooms and exquisite dining and orchestra, and just nothing had ever been built like that before. And for people to sail the Titanic, it was a very big deal, right? It was like a point of pride. The maiden voyage, it was the first, it only had one voyage and didn't complete that. So it was a point of like pride to, you know, I'm sailing on this like amazing, unsinkable, glamorous Titanic, and for the first class passengers. And, you know, we can imagine how they came on board in that April in 1912, and, you know, with all their trunks and all their jewels and all their like pomp and arrogance about riding the Titanic, and they thought it was going to be, you know, such a wonderful experience. And none of them thought that in just a few short days they would be like floating on the freezing North Atlantic, like clutching for dear life. Like none of them thought that. None of them saw that death was coming in that dramatic way, right? So then just a few days later, you know, more than half of the passengers, obviously they hit an iceberg, and a series of events that could have been prevented, but they were too proud to, they thought they had an unsinkable ship. And more than half of the passengers drowned and froze to death. Some of them got away in lifeboats. But none of them thought that when they boarded that ship, the Titanic, none of them thought that in a few days they would be clutching for their life and they would die. Like none of them thought that. So death can come, you know, at any moment. You know, we had some young devotees pass away in our community, which none of us thought like that's the next person to go, right? None of us thought that, but that was the next person to go. So we should always try to keep death in mind, that death is coming, and we should endeavor in that way, get up every morning and think that, you know, death can come at any moment. And that way we are in a good position, right? And take shelter of Krishna and daily endeavor in our sadhana to the best of our ability. Then we are not a household dog. Then we are in a good position. And there's also that Latin phrase, memento mori, out of which a whole art genre evolved in the Middle Ages, but it came from the Romans. Latin, memento mori, remember that you must die. And then like a whole art genre came out of that, you know, just depicting different art forms. One of them is like three different people of three different age groups and different stations in life. I believe there's like a bishop and like a young boy and someone else, like a laborer or whatever. And they're all dancing with death. There's the skeleton and who's personified as death. And they're all dancing with him. And they're all dancing with him through life. Meaning like he can come at any time for any of them, not just for the old ones. Memento mori, remember that you must die. And sometimes if we've had a loved one pass away when we were young, or we had some difficult situation when we were young, some devastation, we can see it as a blessing in our life because it like loosened the grip on material life. And I'm sure many of you have had tragedies happen, especially if we're young and we had tragedies happen. We can understand. We can see it as mercy from Krishna. You know that our illusion of this material world is loosened. And at that point, we can also decide like what we're going to do with that devastation or the death of a loved one when it comes to us, and especially early in life. You know, something like that can either like destroy us or it can lift us up to a new platform of like spiritual endeavor, right? So it's up to us to decide like which way it's going to take us, some devastating event. You know, is it going to destroy us? Is somebody going to take shelter of, you know, drugs or depression or suicide? Or are they going to, you know, work through that in whatever way they need to and rise to a higher platform and then say like, yes, now I understand there is more to life than this here and now and this flimsy material world. And we heard that recently also, the flimsy material world. There's more to it than this, and I will rise to a higher platform and engage in devotional service. And so it's always up to us to choose that, right? Especially when some difficult event comes. Am I going to be bettered by this event? Am I going to be more spiritual, or am I going to let it, you know, bring me down and destroy me? It's a very nice example of that recently. It's sort of material example, but you'll see how it applies here and how it is inspiring. I just happened to be walking through the park like one weekend early morning, and there was a bunch of like older people, like seniors, and they were all like in really good shape, And they were playing like on the courts together, and it's called pickleball. I just learned what that was. They told me, explained to me. Apparently, it's like tennis, but it's like ping pong, but on a tennis court. So they were playing, and they were, you know, having a good time, and they were also like competitive, and they were all like in really good shape, and I was like so inspired by them. You know, I was like, you know, these people are like 80 years old and such, and they're like in really good shape, and they seem to be having a good time, and they were, you know, socializing with each other. And I just like, it was just like struck me, and I was sort of inspired by it. And I was speaking to one of them later on. They asked me if I wanted to play. I was like, no, I'm just enjoying watching you all. And it occurred to me later on, and I was from speaking to one of them, a few of them, that these were people who, you know, had lost something huge in their lives. You know, they were older and they were like left alone. You know, maybe their spouse had died, or their children had left the home, or, you know, divorcees, whatever. You know, but they had picked themselves up, like, and they had, you know, found a new level of happiness, as difficult as that was. And they were there sort of like, you know, socializing with each other and in really good shape and playing pickleball. And apparently it's like a huge thing. There's like leagues and all sorts of things. And I was just very inspired by them, you know, because I'm sure many of them, they could have very easily just succumbed to depression, or, you know, gone to a nursing home and just slowly and quietly died, you know, but they didn't. They picked themselves up. So I was like, no, I'm just watching you. I'm really inspired by just watching you all. So when our material situation crumbles, we can resurrect ourselves within the framework of devotional service. Mm-hmm. And we can take that tragedy and make it and rise out of the ashes of that tragedy and go deeper into our devotional life. We can increase our determination in devotional service. So our training is to engage daily in our sadhana and to also have the consciousness that death could come at any time. Right? And that is how we overcome material life. That is how we do not get complacent or comfortable in the material life, like a household dog. Right? So the remedial measure for devotees, for death, and you know, there's no remedial measure for death. But there is a remedial measure for devotees, and that is engaging in devotional service, and especially hearing. And in that way, we overcome death. And we overcome complacency or being stuck like a household dog in enjoying material life and thinking that this material life is the all in all. So when Maharaj Parikshit got his death sentence, right, what did he do? He took to hearing. He was hearing for 7 days. And then at the end of the 7 days, he said, let the snake bird come. Let it come and bite me. I'm ready. So that is hopefully our ideal position. Let the snake bird come because I'm ready. And to endeavor in that way every single day. So Prahlad Maharaj says that also it is helpful to have spiritual samskaras from early on in life. Kamara acharit pragya. Kamara, in the tender age of childhood, acharit should practice pragya, one who is intelligent. Can somebody say why? Why is Prahlad Maharaj recommending from early age of childhood one should practice? Some reasons you'd like to say? Thank you. One reason is death can come at any time. Any other reasons? Why should one endeavor to practice from early childhood if we had that good fortune of having those samskaras? But why is early childhood like important? Anyone else? Yes, thank you. Because the impressions made in childhood will stay with you for a very long time. So they'll become like a pillar, right, within you. So ideally, we should have that. I know from my own self, from a very young age, as early as I can remember, I was, you know, in Slovenia. I was my family made me go to church, my brother and I, and I actually liked it. I was, you know, the other kids obviously didn't like it, and my brother didn't like it, but I actually liked going to church. And I know, and also taking to spiritual education. And, you know, I know that those impressions were very fundamental in me even taking up devotional service, right? Because I grew up with those impressions, and it was like a huge pillar within me. So I can definitely see how, you know, those early childhood impressions just stay with you throughout your whole life. I also remember how the priest would ask me to, I was very young, eight to 10 years old, and the priest would ask me, because he saw that I liked the scriptures and, you know, just learning about, you know, Jesus and spiritual life, and he thought I could read nicely in front of people, so he would ask me to stand up in front of the congregation. I was very young and you know, read from the scriptures to the people. And you can see I'm still kind of doing that. You can see how that samskara stayed. Also Prabhupada says those early impressions are important because otherwise we get overcome by modern civilization, right? And it's soul-killing ways. Modern civilization, not referring to the verdicts of Vedic literature, is so cruel to the members of the human society that instead of teaching children to become brahmacharis, it teaches mothers to kill their children even in the womb. And if by chance a child is saved, he is educated only for sense gratification. Yeah? We can all, well, most of us can attest to that who've been like in the world. Material education is infected with three modes, and it only trains one for sense gratification. And ultimately it is cruel because it is soul killing. This is from the teachings of Prahlad Maharaj. Spiritual education, there is a great need in society for spiritual education, and it is transcendental. There's a, from the ancient Romans, you know, I like to like quote them sometimes because there's just like so much can be like said about them and like sort of taken, you know, incidents from them and like dissected and seen in a spiritual light. So they had this idea about that to please the masses and to also gain like political control, and they had this idea of like bread and circus. Like if you give the masses, you know, and there were, you know, ancient Rome spanned like 1,200 years, so there were like some very good leaders and there were like some really bad ones. So, you know, we can't all just homogenize ancient Rome into one thing. It was like many different things. But the idea of bread and circus is to win political control, like just give the people bread and circus, meaning like just make sure they have enough food, and circus, just make sure they have, you know, entertainment and distraction. By that, we are keeping the masses, are the Roman mob is kept happy, and you know, the leaders will be liked as long as the masses have, you know, bread and circus. And you can see also how this has filtered down to like modern life, right? Bread and circus, especially all those plethora of, you know, television stations and shows and entertainment and Facebook, right? Just keeping the masses very much distracted and entertained to death, right? And in Roman times, they had like some really horrible, horrible, cruel entertainment. I'm sure you've all heard of the Colosseum in Rome. I don't know if you know or not, but you know, some of the things that went on there were like pretty horrible. You know, just to like please the mob, the Roman mob. And, you know, they would have, people died regularly in those entertainments, the gladiators, some of you heard of them. But basically they fought to the death, you know, and usually someone had to die in those battles. And the mob, the Romans loved it, right? They were entertained by that. And it had to become like bloodier and bloodier. You know, people were eaten by lions as entertainment. People were like crucified. You know, they had like reenactment of battles in the Colosseum, right? Where like the enemy dies and people like really died. It was like really horrible, horrible idea of bread and circus. And just like trying to feed the mob like just more and more, you know, just to, you know, satisfy their increasingly, you know, greedy senses for like spectacle and entertainment. We can also see this in like modern films, right? And this like violence and just over the top like sensory engagement, right? In those horrible video games, they're like so bloody and people are just, you know, chopped to death and they die. So we can see how this bread and circus idea is still very much alive and well in our modern society, right? So that is all, of course, soul killing. That is a soul killing civilization and a soul killing education and way of life. But if we have nothing else, if we don't have spiritual life, then we can see how like one would need like ever more sense gratification to like try to become satisfied, right? So devotional service offers like something different, you know, like, a different endeavor than just more and more bread and circus. We can see how children today also, you know, obviously the ones that are not in devotional schools or not devotees, how they're, it seems like they're like increasingly more and more busy with like extracurricular activities and sports. And, you know, just from like a very young age, they're like having to play like super competitive sports. If you ever like notice that, if you have friends who are not devotees, you know, if you go to like those fields in Alachua, there's like 5 to 7 year olds like playing, you know, baseball or softball, and it's like super competitive, you know, they're super like competitive, and parents are like cheering them on, you know, and they have to like win the affection of their parents by like performing well, you know. And this is all like soul killing and horrible. Remember, I went to such a high school in New York State. I grew up in Slovenia, but then from high school years, my family came to America and went to high school in New York State, not New York City. And it was such a contrast to life in Slovenia, because life in Slovenia is very simple, in a good way. You know, it's very much in harmony with nature and kind of sattvic, you know, and people like to get together and like go hiking together, or, you know, it was back then. I don't know. Now it's like more American. Like, I came here and I went to high school here, and it was just high school that was like all about sports. It was like extremely sports oriented. We were like a very small school, but somehow we had like really good sports programs and athletes, and especially basketball. And if you had some athletic ability, you were drawn into that, and it was completely like taking over your life. You know, we would go to different schools to have different games and meets, and you know, it was just completely overtaking your life. And I was just thinking, like, what is this, you know? Like, it's like you can't even just be yourself. You have to just perform and like be a really good athlete and defeat, you know, the opposing schools. And if you did, like, you were really liked by the school, you know, administration and faculty, and like, oh, this person's such a good athlete, you know. What is this? So you can understand how also this is soul killing. Anyway, I'll stop here and see if there's any discussion. Or I thought if somebody could talk and wanted to say like what childhood impressions they've had, which, you know, stays with them to this day and which influences their life in a positive or a negative way. Wanted to share about that, or just some any other discussion, you can do that. I remember one childhood impression where I was, it was an ant pile. I was young and I was just like taking dirt and putting it on top of the ant pile and kind of plugging up the hole and then watching them all scurry and then taking water also. And I wasn't killing them, but I was definitely making life difficult for them. And yeah, right. That would be like Vidura, you know. Yeah, that's me.
Anyway,
to you.
You know, I was doing that, and then I thought, oh, you know, like, they have no idea like, where this is all coming from. You know, I'm kind of like the controller here, and, you know, I'm making, you know, them scurry around, and all of a sudden, I just had a feeling, and I turned my head, and I looked up, and I thought, well, who's doing that to me? Who's doing that to me? Like, I'm not in control either. Like, there's so many things that are going on that I have no control over, so that really left an impression on me that someone was looking at me the same way that I was looking at the ants.
Nice. Yeah. We had some spiritual, some scars already to even think like that. Thank you.
Just made me think about, this was, I was living in Libya at that time. I was 11 years old, or yeah, I was 11, and
Libya, wow.
What's that?
Wow, Libya.
Yeah, yeah. My father was a diplomat, so right. We lived in a lot of different countries. So the place we were living was like four buildings and a middle compound. So we kids would just all come and gather there. And they were rabbits that we all kids, there were a couple of rabbits that somebody's, there were someone's rabbits, a black and a white one. And so we kids would just all play with the rabbit. And that was just like one of the fun things we did. So one day we came out of the house and we were looking for the rabbit. And another kid told us that somebody took it and they cooked it. And we were like, and I just remember thinking, oh my God, like they did that? And you know, we grew up vegetarian and everything, and
oh, that's nice.
we didn't eat meat or anything, but and we knew other people ate meat. But it never occurred to, like, it was really an eye-opener to think like, oh, this is what people do? Like, they actually cook something like that and they eat it up? So that was like a real, like, eye-opener for me to see that that's what people do.
Nice.
And then as kids, it was like so sad. We were so sad, you know, pets. Mm-hmm. We didn't have our own pets, but yeah, that was our pet. Anyway.
Thank you. That's really nice. Anyone else, please share? Or any other questions? Or comments or inputs?
Hare Krishna. Sure. I have another anthill story.
Okay.
Reminded me, Mataji was telling me about, like, talking about her anthill story. So I think I was 8 or 9 years old, living in New Jersey, but visiting uncles and cousins in Santa Fe, New Mexico. Okay. And one day we were, you know, just running through the landscape, sort of a desert-like terrain. And I think this is a little parallel to the Titanic story.
Okay.
In that at some point I became very, very tired, and I saw in front of me a wonderful just nature-made stool that I could sit down and relax on. So I did, not knowing it was an anthill.
Oh, no.
And I instantly became completely covered from head to toe with biting red ants.
Oh, no.
It was a sudden contrast from just enjoying life like anything, playing, enjoying the company of my brother and my cousins, and sitting down and being bitten in every part of my body.
Oh, Christian.
So I had to be, fortunately I didn't pass out, I could have, but I was, you know, rushed into the house and bathed and covered with some kind of medicinal oils and herbs, and I recovered. But it was a wake-up call. I had an early age.
Yes, never expected that.
Yeah.
Sitting down on that nice stool.
Another example of padam padam yadi yi padam natesham was just 1 week ago. I was in a grocery store, and my wife and I were shopping, and we were at the cash register, and there was something that she had forgotten to get. So I said, well, I'll get it. And so I walked quickly to the other side of the store. I turned down an aisle, not realizing it had just been washed, and my feet went out from under me, and I landed hard on my head. I didn't pass out, but I could have. It really shook the building. It was so hard. I got off my back and kneeled to stand up. A trail of blood started just rushing and created a huge pool. So the employees there saw that, and they called EMS. They called the 911. I had the firemen there. I had the nurses, the EMS came. Fortunately, I'm you know, sitting here telling the story.
Literally danger at every step.
Yeah, but it could have been the end. And could have been, it felt like it should have been, but, you know, no, I didn't. I know. And they were, you can't imagine how gladdened they were that I didn't, you know, make a case out of it, because I could have, but, you know, I don't like to spend my time in such things.
Thank you for sharing.
But it's just a very good example and another wake-up call.
Anything could change at any moment. Yeah. Thank you. Thank you. Anything else? Okay. Friends read Srimad Bhagavatam Ki Jai.